I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The White House is not responding to reports that high-level administration officials, from Vice President Dick Cheney on down, helped choreograph harsh interrogation techniques on al-Qaeda suspects. ABC News broke the story, detailing how the National Security Council's Principals Committee met at the White House and approved tough interrogation tactics, including waterboarding, which many critics call torture. ABC News legal correspondent Jan Crawford Greenberg spent 5 months investigating the story and joins us now. Welcome, Jan.
Thank you, Anthony.
Tell us first, when did these meetings happen and who was there?
Well, it was in the aftermath, of course, of September 11th, and officials feared another attack was imminent. Information about Al-Qaeda was very scarce at that point, and they captured Abu Zubaydah in Pakistan. He was considered a top Al-Qaeda operative, and they tried to interrogate him. He would not cooperate. So the CIA wanted to use more physical, more aggressive methods. And at that point, they went into the administration to try to get the legal approval and also the approval from these senior advisors.
And when you say these senior advisors, who among the senior advisors was there?
The Principals Committee is the president's most senior and trusted advisors on national security. So it's a formal group. They have very regular meetings in the White House Situation Room. It includes Vice President Cheney, then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, George Tenet was there, the Attorney General John Ashcroft. And all of these meetings, the Principals Committee meetings, are chaired by the National Security Advisor, who at that point was, of course, Condoleezza Rice.
And what do we understand that they discussed specifically?
The ways would work is the CIA director or a lawyer would go into these meetings, say they had, you know, X guy, and this is what the CIA wanted to do. Generally, Condoleezza Rice would look over to the attorney general, who would say, well, yes, that was legal. And then that would lead to a discussion about the CIA's interrogation plan and those specific techniques they wanted to employ, including the number of times the CIA wanted to use those techniques. It was a very detailed discussion. These advisors were deeply involved in the details of what the CIA was going to do. Then after this discussion, they would generally agree. My sources say they recall none of the principals objecting to these techniques, and they would just move on to their next agenda item. And this took place, as I said, over the course of a couple years, those tense years in the aftermath of September 11th, when the CIA was wanting to use those quite aggressive and harsh interrogation methods on those high-value Al-Qaeda operatives that they had in some of those secret prisons overseas. This was not about Guantanamo or some of the military interrogations. This focused on the CIA.
And I guess what's significant about this is that this is the first time we've learned that a handful of the most senior Bush administration advisors explicitly knew about and approved these tactics.
That's exactly right, Anthony. And the significance of that is that the White House has just kind of repeatedly in the years since insisted that these techniques were legal, that they have authority from the Justice Department. And, you know, the implication was they were, you know, kind of arm's length. Well, you know, the Justice Department signed off and then the CIA went, you know, and did this. But what we have been told now from multiple sources was that no, these senior advisors were involved in the details, repeatedly involved in the details of these high-value Al-Qaeda interrogations by the CIA. Mm.
And do we know what kind of details? We mentioned waterboarding. I mean, was that the most extreme sort of form of this harsh interrogation tactic that was discussed?
We don't know yet what some of these more specific tactics, separate from the ones, you know, slap, push, even waterboarding, deprivation of sleep that this group discussed. And we do not know at this point which specific detainees were subjected to which techniques beyond a couple. The White House, of course, has declined to comment on this. Cheney and the Vice President, their spokesmen, have declined to comment through the White House. We also reached out, of course, to Tenet, Rumsfeld, and Ashcroft, and they too, as well as Powell, have declined comment.
And Jan, according to one of your sources, the former Attorney General John Ashcroft, he worried out loud that they shouldn't be involved in discussing these details, saying at one point, history will not judge this kindly.
That's right. The Attorney General believed that the Justice Department said these techniques were legal and that these top advisors in the White House should not be discussing some of these grim details, that was just inappropriate for them to be having these kind of discussions in the White House.
Okay, Jan. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That's ABC News legal correspondent Jan Crawford Greenberg, who spent 5 months investigating how high-level Bush administration officials from Vice President Dick Cheney on down approved specific interrogation techniques of al-Qaeda suspects. The Olympic torch relay and the controversy surrounding it has moved to South America. Thousands of police are mobilized on the streets of Buenos Aires in anticipation of more protests when the relay resumes this afternoon. Following disruptions in London, Paris, and San Francisco this week, the torch controversy was very much the focus in China today, where the head of the Beijing Olympic Games met with senior officials of the International Olympics Committee. Among the concerns, security as the torch relay continues around the world. Joining us from Beijing is Mei Fong, China correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. And Mei, what did Chinese Olympic organizers say about the trouble surrounding the torch relay?
Well, they've condemned it very much so. There's a very strong feeling both within the Chinese Olympic officials and the Chinese themselves that that this thing has gotten out of hand. They see a lot of pictures of, say, you know, athletes in wheelchairs being sort of pounced upon by protesters. There's a very strong feeling here that there's a lot of China bashing going on, and it's very unfair.
And did Olympics organizers say anything about canceling any part of this relay or the future of the torch relays in general?
No. They have very much reaffirmed and agreed that this route will go unchanged. It will go to Tibet. There's no indication that they will change the route. However, if you look at it realistically, they have already altered the route to some extent. For example, in San Francisco, it was much shorter than originally planned. But the IOC says that all the stops are still going to be there. So Buenos Aires, Dar es Salaam, and all the stops they plan for in China are going to be there. However, it may be the route itself within the cities that could be subject to change.
Mei Fong, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much.
That's Mei Fong, China correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, joining us from Beijing. For some broader context about all this, we turn now to David Walachinsky, author of The Complete Book of the Olympics. He joins us from Santa Monica, California. And David, very simply, why is this Olympic torch relay so controversial?
It's controversial because this is the first time in 28 years that the Olympics have been hosted by a dictatorship. We had a global torch relay just 4 years ago prior to the Athens Games, and there were absolutely no problems. So these problems with this torch relay are specific to the fact that the Games are in Beijing.
We wanted to turn to you because of your role as a historian. We know that the Olympics dates back to ancient Greece, but what's the history of this torch-bearing ceremony? Does that also go back to ancient Greece?
No, not at all. There were, flames in ancient Greece, but the actual torch relay was created by the Nazis in 1936.
By the Nazis?
Yes.
Wow.
The 1936 Olympics were held in Berlin. The Nazis got the idea that they could link ancient Greece with the Aryan philosophy, and so they got this idea of lighting the torch in Olympia, Greece, and running it to Berlin, which they did. And it had some great images attached to it.
This astounds me. I'd never heard this. Why has this tradition persisted so long, given the history dating back to Nazi Germany?
Well, because when the torch relay was reestablished in 1948 and the games after that, people forgot about the Nazis, and it was kind of a nice thing to see the torch travel around, to see if you've ever seen it go through. It's quite moving. I've seen people, crying when they see it. They don't really know why. It's like an international version of patriotism. Hmm. You suddenly feel you're part of humanity and not just alone, and it's really quite wonderful. I've always been a great supporter of the torch relay, despite its origins. But I think the branding of the torch relay has been just destroyed this year.
This week, IOC Chairman Jacques Roga told reporters that the turmoil surrounding the torch was a crisis. Is he right? It sounds like you agree with him.
Yes, I do think it's a crisis. It's not a crisis that will stop the Olympic movement, but it is a crisis because what was a almost sacred symbol of the Olympic movement, the torch relay, is something now that is instead a symbol of Chinese human rights abuses.
Hmm. How should the athletes be handling this controversial moment? I mean, when it's their moment to be on the stage, I guess.
The Olympic Charter states that athletes are not allowed to make political, religious, or racial statements at an Olympic venue. But Dr. Roga has now stated that the head of the International Olympic Committee, that he feels it's all right for the athletes to make statements during press conferences or when meeting with the media, even if it's at an Olympic stadium. So this is a really, really an opening up of the interpretation of the Olympic Charter.
Mm. In the wake of the protests, we've also heard that British Prime Minister Gordon Brown will not be attending the opening ceremonies. It's unclear whether President Bush will attend, though a White House spokesperson said it's too soon to know, and it's really a question of whether his schedule permit it. What do you make of that? Does this create some kind of precedent one way or the other?
I actually find it a bizarre issue that people are saying that President Bush should boycott the opening ceremonies, because in reality, no U.S. president has ever attended a foreign Olympics. And so President Bush would actually be breaking tradition by attending the Beijing Games and the opening ceremony. So to me, it's not even a question of boycotting. It would be really disturbing to see, for the first time, a president of the United States attend a foreign Olympics and choose Olympics which are being held in a dictatorship.
Hmm. Well, speaking of China and the way China's handling this torch relay so far, we've seen and we've heard reports about these guards dressed in snappy blue and white tracksuits protecting the torch. They were in Paris, in London. They were members of parliament demanding to know how they got there, why they were in the country. We understand as well that they were in San Francisco protecting the torch. What do you make of this? Is this normal, understandable, acceptable in your view?
It's normal to have security protecting the torch. What's disturbing about what's going on this year is that these Chinese security guards have really intervened in upsetting ways, and they've done so on foreign soil. We saw in San Francisco where one of the torchbearers pulled out a Tibetan flag, and they just pulled the torch away from her and pushed her away.
Hmm.
In addition, even in London, you saw them yelling at the runners, hurry up, hurry up, and then actually pushing their arm higher in the air to get the flame higher. And the reason they're doing that is, from the point of view of the Chinese Communist Party, this is all about creating video images that they can show on Chinese television to their own people.
Hmm. Well, Mr. Walachinsky, thanks so much for talking to us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's David Walachinsky, author of The Complete Book of the Olympics. After a break, we'll hear more about those men who are guarding the torch. They're members of China's elite paramilitary force. And later in the show, a new documentary by TV talk show host veteran Phil Donahue on the human cost of war. It's Here and Now. We're discussing the controversy over the Olympic torch relay for the Beijing Games this summer. Today, Japan joined Australia in saying it will not accept those blue and white track-suited Chinese security guards who've been jogging alongside the torch to protect it. They were called thugs by the head of the London Olympics after the guards tackled a protester and barked orders to torchbearers. They grabbed the torch and extinguished the flames several times during protests in Paris. And in San Francisco, they pulled one torchbearer with a protest flag out of the race. We now turn to Murray Scott Tanner, an independent contractor who's a specialist on Chinese police. And Scott, who are these young men protecting the Olympic torch? They're being referred to as the Olympic Torch Relay Flame Protection Unit. Who are they?
Well, they are just that. They are members of China's paramilitary People's Armed Police Force. The specific group was put together for the Olympics last year, and they have two corps, one of several dozen that are following the torch overseas and one that are tasked with guarding the torch while it's in China.
Hmm. Well, Scott, say more about the People's Armed Police. Tell us more about who they are.
The People's Armed Police are an enormous, probably 700 to 800,000 person force of paramilitary police that China has. They range between the functions of China's civilian police, called the Public Security Forces, and China's regular military. They have an enormous array of functions, from acting as bodyguards to paramilitary forces dealing with riots, and that's the function in which we've seen them active in Tibet recently on TV. But they also guard China's gold supply. They guard foreign dignitaries that come to China. They also supply the security on China's airlines and railways for visitors who come to China.
I understand that the People's Armed Police were created just before Tiananmen Square. Is that correct?
The Chinese Communist Party has had paramilitary forces like this going back to well before 1949, but the current version of the People's Armed Police were established in 1983. The Tiananmen demonstrations and massacre were a turning point for them. I was a graduate student in Beijing during those protests and massacre, and got to see firsthand that they failed miserably to carry out modern, effective, low-violence crowd control. And it's because of them that the protests grew to such a large size that the leadership felt, quite immorally in my view, that they had no choice but to use massive, violent force by regular military troops to clear the square. Since Tiananmen, there's been a major effort to try to strengthen the professionalism of these forces to get them better able to deal with that type of a crisis, although, as Tibet has shown, they still have a long way to go.
Hmm. And is it unusual that they're outside of China in this capacity, guarding the torch?
Yes, it is. As far as I'm aware, the only major functions that they perform overseas is that some of them, I believe, take part in UN peacekeeping operations, and they're also responsible for guarding China's embassies overseas. But the manner in which they're being used now as guards for the torch is very unusual and clearly is creating a good deal of controversy among Western publics.
Yeah. How do you think they're comporting themselves? What's your view? We heard some a strong judgment from Mr. Walachinsky just a few moments ago. Do you agree with that?
I do largely agree with Mr. Walachinsky. I don't think that this was well considered. I think the fact that these are China's anti-riot police meant that it was almost certain that a lot of people were going to be offended by having them on foreign soil, or at least that they were going to be a focus of political complaint and protest. The other thing is, as Mr. Walachinsky pointed out, there have been persistent reports, and we've seen on TV, that they've been jostling people, that they've been acting almost like they thought they had law enforcement authority in a foreign country, which, of course, they don't. The torch needs to be guarded for sure, but I think that it probably would have been wiser to arrange for that security to be done by the domestic forces of the countries in which it is being carried.
But is this any different, for example, than U.S. Secret Service agents accompanying a U.S. mission of government officials abroad? I mean, certainly they would act the same way to protect the interests that they were there to guard.
I think that's probably an overdrawn analogy. Certainly, the U.S. Secret Service accompanies U.S. officials overseas, and most countries bring their own security people to guard their heads of state. But what we're talking about here is the Olympic torch, and we're talking about a really unique interaction with local crowds. The likelihood that these People's Armed Police officials would have ended up jostling with foreign citizens was really fairly likely and extremely predictable. And what do we do if something goes wrong? If one of these guys gets upset, or someone pushes him too hard and he strikes back with force, or jostling ensues, are we going to detain this person for assault? It strikes me as not having been a wisely thought through way of guarding the torch, even though, as Mr. Walshinsky very correctly pointed out, this is about images for the Chinese government. And these big, strong, tall, they're all apparently over 6 foot three security officials in their blue tracksuits running along at high speed provide a very powerful, virile picture for the Chinese government. But they also inevitably create risks of some very serious complications when they come into contact with protesters.
Well, Scott, thanks so much for joining us today.
Pleasure is mine. Thank you.
That's Murray Scott Tanner, an independent contractor who's a specialist on Chinese police. He spoke to us from Rockville, Maryland. Still ahead today, tax tips for late filers, such as how to make sure you get those government rebate checks as soon as possible and how to avoid that dreaded audit. It's Here and Now. The cost of war can be explained by numbers, numbers like these. More than 4,000 Americans killed, tens of thousands wounded, not to mention the much, much higher number of Iraqi casualties. The cost can also be explained through the story of one person, like 26-year-old Thomas Young. In 2001, Young enlisted in the Army because he wanted to go to Afghanistan and fight those responsible for 9/11. Instead, he was sent to Iraq, where he was wounded on the fourth day of his deployment. A bullet severed his spine, paralyzing him from the chest down.
It was April 4, 2004, and I took a shot right above the left collarbone.
That's from the new documentary film Body of War, which tells the story of Thomas Young's efforts to regain his life back home in Kansas City. Body of War was co-directed by Phil Donahue, the veteran TV talk show host turned movie maker, who joins me now in the studio. And welcome, Phil Donahue.
Thank you, Anthony.
It's great to have you. Tell me how you met Thomas Young.
I met Thomas at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, first visit there. Actually, the invitation was extended to Ralph Nader. And in a conversation with Ralph, he mentioned this, and do I want to go? And I said, yes, I had never been there. So off we go about a week later, and here I am walking into this room where this young man, very thin and whacked out on medication, morphine, was lying there, and I'm standing next to his mother, and she explained to me the nature of his injuries. He's paralyzed from the nipples down. Thomas can't walk.
Right.
24 years old when he was shot. So I'm thinking, wow, this is awful, and the American people should see this.
The film, as you've just mentioned, takes a close and unflinching look at the day-to-day challenges that Thomas faces. For example, there's a scene when he's talking about all the medications he has to take. He describes this while we hear the congressional roll call vote in favor of the war authorization. I want to play that clip and then just talk about it a little more, so let's listen for a moment.
This is carbamazepine. It is a nerve pain medication.
Ms. Collins, aye.
This is a drug called Coumadin, and it's a blood thinner.
Mr. Craig, aye.
This is tizanidine. It's an anti-spasm medication.
Mr. Crapo, aye.
This is gabapentin.
Mr. Daschle.
Phil Donahue, tell me about that scene. I mean, it's very troubling with the roll call vote in the background and this very kind of gritty look at what he has to deal with on a daily basis.
Right. Woven throughout our film, Anthony, as you know, is the scenes from the debate on the Iraq War resolution in October 2002. The comments being made are handouts from the White House.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking points. A smoking gun will become a mushroom cloud.
And you see the lawmakers sort of parroting these lines from the White House.
The
again
longer
and again.
We wait, the more dangerous he becomes. Saddam is coming. He's got this. He's got that. He's going to be here. You can feel the heartbeat of the nation accelerate. You're watching this. And it's an instruction on what you can do to an entire population if you scare them. This is the politics of fear, and it worked.
And it's contrasted to the sort of daily challenge of Thomas Young and what he's dealing with. We see him struggling to get dressed. You see him struggling with great difficulty getting in and out of cars. We even see his mother struggling to catheterize him so he can empty his bladder. Why was it important for you to focus the camera so closely on these painful everyday details.
Because I think this is the most sanitized war of my lifetime. The president said you can't take pictures of the coffins. And the entire mainstream media said, okay, these injuries are turning the lives of the injured upside down and the entire family as well.
Obviously, it's an unflinching anti-war film. Are you concerned, though, that you're not going to reach people that really need to hear it? And the reason I ask is this. We know that these films that Hollywood is producing, Americans are choosing not to go to them. They're not going in great numbers. And I'm just wondering if your sort of unflinching anti-war message is at risk of being perceived as preaching to the choir. Mm-hmm. Do you think about that?
Sure. Yeah. Every day. And so our film is only 87 minutes long. So Anthony will have you to dinner before 9 o'clock. And what you see in our film is a drama that's being played out in thousands of homes in this country. People whose loved ones have come back with catastrophic injuries. And the American people don't see this. Mm. They do not see it. It seems to me there is no really heartfelt connection between the American people and the less than 5% of us who have really sacrificed for this war. Mm.
There's another scene I want to talk to you about. Thomas Young visits Bobby Mueller, a Vietnam War vet who was also paralyzed because of his wounds, actually the same kind of wound that Thomas suffered. And it's sort of a touching scene, the older Mueller talking to the younger vet about his wounds and his recovery. And let's just listen for a moment.
How long were you in the hospital?
A week and a half in Germany, a month, about 2.5-3 months, separated over different hospitals.
I was in the hospital for a year. And then I went on an outpatient basis for another 9 months. You got short shrift.
This is a troubling scene. You really get the sense that Thomas Young isn't getting the care that he needs. And it's very apparent when you see him next to Bobby Mueller, who is in a wheelchair but looks strong, robust. His body seems to be functioning as well as it could be expected to. Whereas Thomas spends a lot of this film with dizzy spells, sort of folded over in his chair. He's a troubling physical specimen.
By all means. They talk about guy stuff. Being able to be intimate with a woman. And Bobby is trying to tell Thomas that, you know, this can happen. You can do this. I do. In fact, he's even in a locker room macho way. He's saying, you're going to be an ace. What's a sacrifice to us? We don't see this. Yeah. My own inspiration for this film was that picture of the child running naked away from the napalm in Vietnam. Do you remember that picture?
Absolutely.
It's a screaming, looks to me, 7-8-year-old little girl, totally naked, running, screaming. You could see the black smoke in the background. That picture won a Pulitzer Prize. You know, we got to get back to this kind of journalism.
Tell me about what this journey means from you. I'm sure there are a lot of people listening that still recall you as a TV talk show host. This is your first foray into filmmaking.
Yeah.
How do you like it? I mean, is this the start of something new for Phil Donahue?
I'll tell you, it's a contact sport, really. This has been a long and winding road. It also has been a matter of the heart for everybody who worked on this. This is a fabulous family, you know? This is a mother. You look up mommy in the dictionary is a picture of this Thomas's mother, Kathy. When you see this, the closer you get, the more it blows you back. Hmm. And I just think the American people should see this.
The film is Body of War. It's a very powerful film. Phil Donahue, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us about it.
Thank you, Anthony.
That's Phil Donahue, along with Ellen Spiro. He co-directed the new film, Body of War. It's now playing in New York, Washington, and Boston, and opens nationwide later this month. For more on the film, Body of War, go to our website, here-now.org. And next week on Here and Now, we touch down in Pennsylvania, the key site in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. You're listening to Here and Now. It's tax season, and here's a valuable tip. If you've hired actor Wesley Snipes to give you tax advice, dump him immediately. You might recall that Snipes is the latest high-profile advocate of the claim there's no law requiring Americans to pay federal income taxes. For his trouble, the government hauled Snipes into court, where he was found guilty of willful failure to pay his taxes. He's now awaiting sentencing and could end up going to jail for 3 years. So remember, being a successful Hollywood actor, voluntary. Paying taxes, mandatory. To talk now about the looming April 15th filing deadline is Tom Herman, who writes the tax report column for the Wall Street Journal. And Tom, welcome.
Thank you very much, and that was very good advice.
Well, this week, the government announced a new effort to crack down on people who apparently have imbibed the Wesley Snipes Kool-Aid and think that paying taxes is voluntary. What's going on here?
Government officials I've spoken to are increasingly worried about this issue because it's so much easier these days for promoters of tax-defiant schemes to spread their messages on the Internet. The groups themselves estimate that there are several hundred thousand people who believe this. That's a fairly small percentage of the 140 million people or so who file individual tax returns, but it's still a large number of people.
Right, and you mentioned 140 million people paying their taxes. Let's talk about some of them and sort of this deadline that's upon us. The IRS is reporting nearly 80 million filed by the end of March. That's up 6% over the same time last year. Why so many early filings?
The IRS and other people who follow these issues think it's because of these economic stimulus payments that are coming out starting in early May. To qualify for one of these payments, you have to file a tax return. So they're probably getting a lot more returns this year from people who don't ordinarily have to file because they don't make enough income to qualify to file.
Hmm. And what else do we need to know in order to get these checks as soon as possible?
The easiest way to get them is to file electronically and to sign up for what's called direct deposit. That means ask the IRS to shoot your refund directly into your bank account electronically instead of using snail mail. Those checks will start going out electronically on May 2nd. They're going to send paper checks beginning May 16th.
Hmm. So there's some good advice about those stimulus rebate checks. What else is giving people trouble with their returns this year? What other advice do you have?
Well, there are many changes this year. There's an old joke that Congress is trying very hard to make sure whatever tax advice we got last year is wrong, and that's why they constantly are changing the rules on us. But there are some new provisions you need to be aware of. For instance, this year, many people will be eligible for a new deduction for mortgage insurance premiums that they paid for in 2007. There's also a new record-keeping rule for your cash donations. Now, no matter how small your cash gift, you need a receipt that shows the name of the charity. It's got to show the name, date of your gift and the amount.
I see. And what do we need to understand about avoiding that dreaded IRS audit? We're hearing that the IRS is increasing the number of audits they'll perform. Why is this, and what are they looking for?
The IRS faces tremendous pressure from Congress to collect more money. It's in part because of an IRS study that showed there's a $290 billion gap between what the IRS actually collects each year and what it thinks it should be collecting. Mm-hmm. Congress looked at that and said, hey, the IRS really needs to do a better job of collecting the revenue, and one way to do that is to increase audits. Even so, the IRS only audits about 1% of all the returns filed. That's up quite a bit from where it was a few years ago, but it's still a fairly low number.
Hmm. Tom, are there particular areas that taxpayers need to be aware of in terms of these new audits?
Yes. IRS studies show that much of the cheating and other forms of noncompliance comes from what are called self-employed workers, such as consultants or small business owners. The reason is very simple. A lot of these people don't have taxes withheld from their pay, and their income is not reported separately to the government.
Hmm. So, Tom, you mentioned that $290 billion a year tax gap. Who makes up that difference?
That $290 billion tax gap is made up by the rest of us, by law-abiding people who pay what their fair share is. That's part of the reason that Congress is placing so much pressure on the IRS to do a better job of collecting money. Also, they figure it's much easier politically for the IRS to collect money from people who really owe it than it is for Congress to have to raise taxes.
That's Tom Herman. You can find his weekly tax report column in the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Anthony.
And coming up, music from Bollywood diva Asha Bhosle. Stay with us here and now. Natasha Bosley may not be a household name here in the U.S., but she has diva status in those parts of the world where Bollywood reigns, including her native India and a wide swath of Asia. And many musicians around the world know and respect Asha Bosley. She's collaborated with R.E.M.'s Michael Stipe and the Kronos Quartet, and groups including the Black Eyed Peas sample her song. Asha Bhosle made her name as a playback singer in Indian cinema. That means she does the singing off-camera for the lip-syncing actresses on screen. But Asha Bhosle is as big a draw as any leading lady. Now she's marking her 75th birthday with a tour of the U.S. and Canada. And Asha Bhosle and her son Anand join me from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you. Asha Bhosle, to American audiences who know little about Bollywood, the films from Bombay, explain why singing and dancing are so central in Bollywood film.
People like it, songs very much. That's why film was running at that time. And now it's a little bit modern, very modern. And people like it, dance. And they listen music for dance.
It's like the old MGM musicals. So they started on the same kind of footing, and sort of like we were the originators of MTV, I think. Before MTV, people used to go to movies to watch the song.
But it seems like it's even bigger. I mean, here's what I wanted to ask you, Miss Bhosle, and that is, in the U.S., the singers who sing the songs that the on-screen actors lip-sync generally aren't known. They're anonymous. But you, as well as your sister, are both big, big stars in the Indian film world. Why do these songs become such big hits?
The artists can't sing, so they took our voices. And my sister and myself give best, feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why people like it, my songs and my sister's voice.
I wanted to ask you, Miss Bhosle, do you think of yourself as you perform your songs for these movies? Do you also think of yourself as an actress?
Inside we are acting. We have to act in the voice. So we are a little bit actresses.
Anand, I wanted to ask you a question. I read that you remember going to see your mother sing in the early 70s. Your aunt was featured, your mother's sisters. Then it was your mother's turn to sing, and she came on stage with the man she would later marry, R.D. Burman. And they sang a song called Dum Maradum. Set the scene. Tell us what that was like.
I think it was early 70s. And this song, Dum Maradum, it was like, you know, flower power was at its peak. Came from a movie also, which was picturized on, you know, the hippie movement and all that. And so everybody was taken up with that whole feeling and that whole generation. And in this concert, the last item was this song where my mother was singing and with R.D. Burman. When this started, I mean, you could just see the whole atmosphere change. It just erupted. Everybody was suddenly screaming and shouting, and, you know, it was just like, it just suddenly went from very serene to totally wild.
Well, let's hear a bit of the original version of Dum Maradum. This is music by R.D. Burman. It's sung by your mother. And we should say that the song title translated means take another toke, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Shubh Sham, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
Anand, this was a pretty radical song for its day, correct? I mean, I understand
It
was banned on Indian radio when it first came out.
That's correct. And only Radio Ceylon used to play this. So everybody used to switch on to Radio Ceylon to hear this song. And, you know, All India Radio, which banned it, you know, suffered because it lost all its listeners.
Yeah, Asha Bhosle, tell me what you liked about that song.
I like it tune very much.
It became a super, super hit, right?
Super duper, yeah.
Yeah. And decades later, you recorded the same song again with the Kronos Quartet. Let's listen for a moment.
Dhammarudam
Anand, you are your mother's manager, and you've been watching her for years. What does it mean that she's touring the U.S. and Canada right now?
It's a very special thing. I mean, we've done tours before, but to do a tour at age 75 and still, you know, at the peak of her popularity, I think it's special.
Mm. Asha Bhosle, I want to ask you what's next for you. But before that, I want to play a love song from the film Umrao Jaan. This is a song called Ghazal. Am I pronouncing that right?
Ghazal, yes.
Justju jis ki thi usko tu na paaya. जुस्तजू जिसकी थी उसको तो ना पाया हमने इस बहाने से मगर देख ली दुनिया हमने जुस्तजू जिसकी थी
Asha Bhosle, you've recorded thousands and thousands of songs in dozens of language. Beyond film music, you've recorded love lyrics, religious songs. You mentioned that you like classical songs the best. You're also a composer. At 75, where are you going next? Do you imagine going on recording and singing for many years to come?
Till 90.
What does the manager have to say about that?
I have nothing to say. As long as the audience is, you know, are there and they want to listen more, you know, we carry on. What do we do sitting at home?
Well, Asha Bhosle, thank you so much for coming in today. I appreciate it. It's a real pleasure. And Anand Bhosle, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
There's dancing behind movie scenes, behind the movie scenes. Sadi Rani, she's the one that keeps the dream alive from the morning past the evening.
And we'll end today's program with A Brimful of Asha, a tribute to Asha Bhosle by the British pop group Corner Shop. And for our Boston audience, Asha Bhosle performs this Sunday evening at Symphony Hall. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston, and we wish a fond farewell to our occasional engineering expert, Vince Fairchild, who leaves us today for the bright lights of Broadway. Good luck, Vince. You'll be missed. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.